Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. It's rare for me to find someone who writes a book about something that I'm really, really interested, that I run into and can contact. It's even rarer when there's somebody who's written three books, all about different topics that, you know, if I had the time, the energy, and the brilliance to do it, would have done them myself. So this man has written a book about stand-up comedy. He's also written a book about growing up with old-time radio, so he loves radio very much. And now he's written a book about the culture of America through the 50s and 60s, through the television of the time, and most specifically through Ed Sullivan. To have those kinds of interests, I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to talk to this particular person, especially since he's also been a theater critic and a journalist and a humorist. It's like if you took all the things that I put after my name, you could put them right after his, only he does them more prolifically and probably better. His name is Gerald Nachman, and he's with us on Dave's Gone By in the neighborhood. Welcome, Gerald.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate you being here. I appreciate me being here, you being here, too.
Well, yeah, it's great. I mean, the amazing thing is, when I saw your name and you had written the Ed Sullivan book and these other books, your name started to ring bells because you were a New York columnist and writer and critic for quite a few years.
Yeah, I was. I was, 100 years ago, I was at the old New York Post as a feature writer and a celebrity profiler, and then more recently, meaning 30 years ago, I was at the 35 years, I guess. I was at the New York Daily News, and I wrote a humor column for 7 years for the New York Daily News.
No, okay, let's backtrack already to the New York Post, because the way we think of the New York Post now is this incredibly right-wingy Republican rag.
Right.
Wasn't it liberal when you were writing for it?
It was New York's most liberal paper, and I wasn't quite aware of that at the time. I'm from California. I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area, Oakland, actually, and I knew almost nothing about the New York Post, but I wanted to go to New York, so I left San Jose, where I was writing a TV and humor column, and just left and quit and went back to New York because I always had a New York bug. I wanted to see what New York was all about, so I went back there when I was about 24. And it's a roundabout story, but I ended up at the New York Post because a friend of mine who was in New York told me that it was the best paper for writers, and it really was a good writer's paper. They let you alone, and gave you kind of a lot of freedom. But they were very glamorous days for me, being in New York and young and all that. It's the best time to go to New York is when you're young.
Well, let me ask a quick question, a couple of things. First of all, you left the San Jose paper, a job that you've gotten right out of college. I mean, nobody gets that lucky. Well, I mean, you were obviously good, but the fact is...
Go ahead.
But you went to New York before you had the job waiting for you at the Post. You just figured, I'm going to go and see what happens?
Yeah, actually, to backtrack one little step,
sure.
I was actually in college when I got the job at the San Jose Mercury. I was writing a humor column in the college paper, and I got hired out of that, and I was my senior year, and I was writing a TV column, which was a huge break for a fairly big paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went back to New York just because I had this thing about New York. I wanted to see what it was all about. I'd read about it. It had, you know, terrific lore and appeal and glamour and everything else, and I didn't want to stay in San Jose forever. My family was somewhat appalled because they thought, you know, you've got a great job on a good paper, and why give that up? And I couldn't argue with that, except...
You have a Jewish family, I can tell.
But I had this wanderlust, and I wanted to go to New York, and as I said, I had to see what it was all about. You know, it's a way to test yourself, and I'd been pretty successful, and I was pretty young, so I thought, well, let's see if my luck holds out, and eventually it did. But I started as a summer intern at the old liberal New York Post, and they didn't keep me because they had me doing newspaper hard news, and I'm a terrible reporter at that.
Hmm.
I love feature writing and column writing and reviewing.
But you were able to jump to the Daily News after a certain point.
Well, I went back and forth. I left the New York Post, got married, I came back to San Francisco Bay Area, got a job at the Oakland Tribune. In between the two New York papers, I was a theater and film critic at the Oakland Tribune for 4.5 years. wanted to go back to New York again, and so my wife and I went back to New York in 72, and I caught on at the New York Daily News fairly quickly, and I was a feature writer for a while, and then I asked him if I could do a humor column, because that was my ultimate goal always. And I talked him into it, and I did that for 7 years.
And then...
That was in the 70s.
Right, and then they decided, or you decided, that was enough.
Yeah, I had enough of New York. I kind of wanted to go back and get... I don't know, that's one of those crossroad decisions. You always wonder, you know, how would it have been if I'd stayed. And I actually talked to the editor at the New York Daily News and letting me continue writing my columns from San Francisco. It kind of involved my wife wanted to move back here, and I'd lived there, long, you know, 7 years, and that's a long time. And I always say I never realized what a California guy I was until I lived in New York. I love New York. I just got back from there. I love going once a year for, you know, a couple of weeks, and I get it out of my system, and I come back to reality.
That's what people from New York say when they go out to the coast.
Bay Area, although San Francisco is another unreal place.
Well, yeah. What is the difference between writing for an East Coast paper and a West Coast paper?
Not for me, you know. I just try to do my best, and that's not. Maybe that's a little too flippant answer. There is a difference. Although, so you try your hardest wherever you are, you know, whether it's Podunk or New York City, and although the competition is a little stiffer in New York, there's no question about it. I think you tend to play over your head a little bit, as they say in sports. And I think you write at the very, very top of your skill, because you have to compete. So it's a little faster game. There's no question about it.
And now, are you doing a blog for somewhere? Are you with a paper now, or?
No. I left the San Francisco Chronicle in 1993, 16 years ago, and I've been writing these three books you mentioned since then. And I do write for a website. I don't have a blog. I do write for a website called thecolumnist.com. And I was one of the four co-founders of it, 10 years ago. And I write for them occasionally.
Now, tell us just a little bit about thecolumnists.com. It's basically an aggregate or of people who...
Yeah, it's about entertainment, the arts, sports, anything we want to write about. It's made up of a conglomeration of people that the four founders knew, and then it's since branched out. And so when I have something I want to get off my chest, or when I can't sell it to someone else, it will land on thecolumnist.com. And I've written, you know, probably a couple hundred pieces for him. And,
well, here's this.
You can go there and archive some of my stuff if anyone's interested.
So here's the thing. I mean, you're a person like so many of my colleagues over the past few years. I mean, you have been in the newspaper and journalism business for a long time and often made the decision to leave a major paper when it just felt like time. But so many of my colleagues are in a situation where they're downsized, or they've gone from being a full-time person to being, I guess, adjunct would be almost the word for it, or you know, doing stuff on spec. How does a website like The Columnist make a go of it? Where's the money from?
There is no money. It's totally money. Well, we don't lose money, but the guy that runs it has, you know, he's put in a little of his money just to maintain the site, but it's
but that's a couple of $100. You know, that's,
no ads, you know. Although he's looked into that possibility of getting ads for it, but you need somebody to work at that full time. I don't understand how all that stuff works. So I'm totally a print guy, meaning pen, you know, paper and ink.
No, I was just sort of hoping that...
I don't believe there's anybody out there reading this stuff, so... And, you know, I just don't get any feedback from it, and if I write something that's in a newspaper or magazine, I usually get some feedback, and so it's writing on air to me, and it's you know, you have to do it because that's the new world, but it's not my preference at all. I'd much rather write for a newspaper or magazine.
Well, speaking of writers, one thing that did tickle me, I guess... Either when you were on one of the major papers, you served on the committee that decided the Pulitzer Prize for a play.
For drama, yeah. I got chosen because somebody I knew was on it, and they suggested that they needed a representative from the West Coast.
when you were on the Pulitzer Committee, what year was that, and what was the play? What did you guys select?
Well, it's a play that hasn't been done very much. It was called, I think it was like 69 or something like that. It was a long time ago. And it was a great honor, to be sure. You know, you fly back to New York, and you meet in a room, and you read or see the plays, and it was a thing called the Kentucky Cycle.
Oh, wait, that wasn't that long ago. It wasn't 69. Kentucky
79?
Cycle was...
I don't know, maybe it's 79.
Well, it was actually the year just before, I think, Angels in America. It was probably almost 89, because they did that on Broadway.
But it was a long, it's like a 7-hour thing.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
go
yeah.
And you take a lunch break, or, I mean, a dinner break, and it was quite a good play, considering how long it was. And I have very little, I get impatient easily, but I was held by it. It's a good play, but it takes a lot, big cast, and it's very, complicated to produce, because it's a long, long play.
Yeah, no, I remember, they did it on, it came to Broadway at around the same time Angels in America did.
That's and, right, after and, it won the Pulitzer, it came to Broadway. I think it was done in L.A. or originally at the Arlington Theater.
Talking about writing again, one of your books was about stand-up comedy.
Seriously funny.
Mm-hmm.
The subtitle is The Rebel Comedians of the 1950s and 60s. So it's not just about stand-up comedians, it's about a very specific era, and you know, many of them were stand-ups, but I also dealt with TV comedians and radio comedians, Bob and Ray, and you know, Gene Shepherd, and people like that. Comedians who came along in that era, starting with Mort Saul and ending with Phyllis Diller, were sort of making satirical social commentary, more than just, you know, Henny Youngman one-liners. So it was a very different kind of comedy, and nobody had written a book about that then, and I don't know, I think there have been a couple of similar books since then, but I think mine is the most comprehensive. I like to think that anyway.
So who was the best interview that you had?
Best interview.
I mean, you talked to people like Steve Allen, Woody Allen, Jonathan Winters.
Just amazed. I think I have to say Mike Nichols, who got me, who was, you know, he and Elaine May had a famous comedy team in the early 60s called Nichols and May. Mike Nichols and Elaine May. And he gave me an hour and 45 minutes, which was quite amazing. And he's a busy guy still. And he was very honest. But I liked all of them that I got to. I didn't think I'd get to Woody Allen. And you know, they promised me 20 minutes. And I thought, oh, geez, I can barely, you know, clear my throat in 20 minutes. So, but he ended up giving me 45 minutes, and he answered, you know, he was a very good interview, very businesslike. He's not very personable, but he answers honestly, and, you know, gave me candid answers. And I like Jonathan Winters, who was kind of the most connected best with, even though I talked to him at his home outside Santa Barbara, and he asked me to go to lunch with him. He's the only comedian who did that, and so I liked him for that. And he was also very, very open and honest, and so we had lunch in town, and that was memorable for that reason.
Was there anything that you gained by doing that book that you kind of didn't know going in? In other words, along the span of the late 50s, early 60s, that America was changing, the world was changing, and comedy was part of both the forefront and reflecting that. But what did you learn about comedy from doing the book?
I don't know, probably a whole lot, because I dealt with about 20 comedians, and their lives are very complicated, their ups and downs, and many of them, you know, had a huge career and then went into a slide, like Mort Saul, and many of them, almost all of them actually, there were a few that went into TV and did incredibly well, Bill Cosby and Bob Newhart specifically. But guys like Saul and even Shelley Berman had a long period when he wasn't very popular anymore.
Well, that's interesting.
You know, that's the thing, you explode, and then, you know, then people get used to you, or something happens, or you screw up your career somehow, or your life takes a bad turn. And so that happened with a lot of these people.
Because you would figure
various
that,
ways.
You would figure that someone like Saul, who was doing topical material before, he would have ridden the wave. Whereas, I guess, as opposed to, say, a Shelley Berman, who might have been lumped in with more of the Catskill-y sort of comics because he wasn't political.
Well, he wasn't Catskill at all. He was doing kind of neurotic comedy. He was kind of doing very personal kind of comedy. It was very different. And Saul had this huge burst of excitement and was huge. And then he got waylaid because he got involved in the investigation of the Kennedy assassination.
Oh,
and
he
started, boring audiences by talking about their conspiracy theories and all that. And he never got his traction back all the way, a little bit, and then he was doing political comedy. He was the only one really doing political humor, strictly political humor, at a time, and nobody else was. And now everybody is doing it. You know, Jon Stewart, Bill Maher, and everybody's doing it. It's now kind of boring. I wish they'd get back to, you know, nonsense comedian or comedy again, because they've sort of exhausted it. And but Saul was incredibly sharp, incredibly fast, lightning fast guy. He's kind of a hero of mine. But
I have heard that he's not the nicest person.
He's a very difficult guy. He can be very nice, and he can be kind of prickly, and he doesn't suffer fools gladly, and he's got a huge ego, and he will admit all of this, by the way, which is kind of a saving grace with people who will admit to their flaws. He knows this, and he kind of jokes about it, and he wouldn't even talk to me. I'd interviewed him over the years two or three times and reviewed him always very favorably, because he's a kind of a hero of mine. But he didn't want to talk to me, and I was just, so disappointed and just kind of aghast at that, because we had a good relationship. He says, because it's his vanity, and he says, I don't want to be in that book with all those other guys, because he considers himself better than almost everybody.
Okay.
And then later, though, we did a panel in L.A. He and Tom Smothers, and I was a moderator. He came, and after he read the chapter I did on him in the book, and he's actually on the cover of the book, which I guess didn't hurt. He was apologizing all over himself. I should have talked to you. I don't know what's wrong with me, and blah, blah, blah. So he's really kind of a good guy, but he's a difficult guy.
Did you get the feeling when you were interviewing all these people, the old cliche that most of them are unhappy people?
Not most, but some are. There's no question about it. Jonathan Winters had a dreadful childhood. Saul had a very good childhood. Newhart had a normal childhood. Shelley Berman had a pretty normal childhood. Mike Nichols had an unhappy childhood. If you can go down the list, and it's sort of evenly divided. That's kind of a myth that they all had unhappy childhoods. I don't think that's quite true.
Well, not even.
But some of them did. A lot of dentists probably had unhappy childhoods.
I didn't even mean unhappy childhood. I mean, you can have a perfectly normal or even healthy, happy childhood and still come out a pretty mixed up, screwed up, unhappy person.
That's a good point. I think that's true. You can. Comedians are different. You know, they're very different kinds of people. They see the world in a very skewed way, which, if they're any good, is what makes them funny.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and we are speaking with, a man with so many acronyms after his name, journalist, writer, and appreciator. I don't know why I said acronyms, that's the wrong word, but he's an appreciator of the things that not only I, but I think we all should appreciate. Comedy, radio entertainment, humor. He's been a humorist for so many years, and we're talking with him. We were talking about stand-up comedy. Now let's talk about a broader spectrum of entertainment, because Gerald Nachman has written a book called Right Here, on our stage. Actually, can you say it like Ed Sullivan would?
I don't do a very good imitation. Right Here on Our Stage Tonight.
Not bad.
That's about as good as I can do.
Ed Sullivan's America. It's a publication by University of California Press. Ooh. But please, folks, do not think that this is some kind of academic treatise or journal. I've started reading the book, and you are a really good writer.
Thank you very much.
And I don't say this to BS or
you can say it for any reason.
But I can tell. I can see how you could have written a column like several times a week and just put these books out, because you just have a marvelous flowing style that gets all the facts in but also is very, very readable.
Well, that's the goal, and that's the trick, is to make it informative but not academic, as you say, and I'm trying to make it, you have to entertain the folks, so you try to be as amusing as you can and still, you know, be informative. So it's a balance, and that's the challenge of a book like this.
Now, in investigating and researching Ed Sullivan, what are some of the things that you wouldn't expect to come out of his life and career?
Well, let's see. He was a bit of a womanizer. I didn't know about that. He's kind of, because he was kind of a wooden, frozen face stiff on TV, everyone remembers. But
he looked like a bloodhound.
But what's that?
And he kind of looked like a bloodhound.
Yeah, sort of. He was, but in his youth, we remember, maybe you remember him because you. Because you were just a kid, he was like in the 60s then. But in his youth, in the 30s, he was kind of a good-looking guy. He'd been a jock, and he was, he's kind of a charming guy. He could also be hot-headed and temperamental and difficult, like all these guys. But he was women found him attractive, and so that was kind of new. And then I found out about his boyhood. He had a kind of a difficult boyhood. People don't know much about it, but everything in his past led up inexorably to the TV show. He was an athlete, and then he became a sports columnist, and then he became a Broadway gossip columnist, talking about, that's a category that doesn't even exist anymore. He worked for a lot of New York newspapers, and finally wound up emceeing some stage shows in New York, and out of that came the TV show in 1948, in really the first year of television.
Well, one of the interesting things, you mentioned the whole sports thing that people might not remember, and you make it clear early in the book that personally he was awed by talent and celebrity, but he felt a little bit more comfortable with sports figures. And
that was surprising. Speaking of surprising things, that he didn't mix very much with performers. He was very much at ease with athletes. Sports was always his first love, and he used to put a lot of athletes on his show. He would either introduce them in the audience or have them, like Jackie Robinson or someone, come up on stage, or Rocky Marciano, and kind of spar with him for fun, or talk about hitting with Jackie Robinson, because he loved athletes, and he mixed easily with them. He didn't mix. He was in awe of performers and talent, but he did not feel really much at home with them. He only, as far as I could track down, he only had one really close friend who was in show business, an older singer named Jerry Vale.
Oh, yeah.
An Italian singer.
I should mention, I'm 45 years old, so when you say people like Jerry Vale, I do know who they are.
You know the name. Well, I always have to be aware that people, 20 and 30 are maybe not aware of that. But he sang a lot of Italian songs. He's still around.
Now, one of the other things you mentioned, and I forget their names, but that he had, quote-unquote, feuds of some sort with a few people. Now, most of us think in terms of maybe just one with Jackie Mason. Because they had that misunderstanding.
Yeah, that's the most famous one, because of the finger incident, which everyone wants to know about. And I did interview Jackie Mason. I should say I interviewed 60 performers for this book, which there have been a couple, three other books on Ed Sullivan written a long time ago, and none of them, oddly to me, interviewed any of the performers. I wanted to tell about what the show was like kind of from the inside out, and the only way to do that is to talk to people who actually played the show, and many of them played it very many, multiple times. So I talked to Mason about the finger incident where Sullivan thought Mason was flipping him off on camera. He wasn't. He was making fun of Sullivan was giving him the 1 minute sign.
Right.
He had to cut his routine, and Sullivan drove comedians crazy because he was always trying to get them to cut their routines because, the show was live almost the entire run of 23 years. So that's hard to do, to fit in seven or eight acts and make it come out on time. So he would always go after the comedians because he felt it was easier to cut jokes than it was to cut a song in half. He couldn't do that. But comedy acts are very carefully structured, and a joke in the first part may pay off later. And you just simply can't cut one or two jokes that easily with most comedians. So Mason felt not complicated. The studio audience was watching Ed Sullivan giving the 1 minute sign to Mason. As a result, they weren't responding, and Mason told me he was afraid the home audience, the viewers, would think he was dying. So he started making fun of that. He said, a finger for you, and a finger for you, and a finger for you. And Sullivan was offended. He thought he was being flipped off.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Sullivan was just, Mason was just trying to be funny and trying to salvage the moment. But Sullivan was easily offended, had a thin skin. He didn't like to be crossed, and he felt that Mason was kind of making fun of him. And so he was very, very angry, almost. I talked to a guy backstage who said he wanted to punch him out. But so he wouldn't have him back on his show for many years.
But did Mason ever get back on the Sullivan show?
Yeah, they ran into each other in an airport or somewhere, and they made up. Sullivan was always sorry for some of the feuds he started. He was, as I say, he was kind of a volatile Irishman, and he would blow up, and then it would die, then it would subside very quickly. And he said, I always went around apologizing afterwards. So he could be a good guy, and he just had a. He was just kind of hot-headed, and he made up with Jackie Mason and invited him back on the show, but only once, and Mason told me he thought that was because Sullivan was trying to avoid a lawsuit, because Mason's career had been severely hurt by not being asked back on Sullivan's show, and really not on many TV shows after that, because it was, front page stories around the country for a while, and Mason was going to sue him, and never happened. The judge threw the case out, but it did hurt his career for a while. He worked, but he never worked at TV for many years.
Who were some of the other feudees?
Well, Jack Parr was the other major one. Jack Parr was host of the Tonight Show for many years, and it was over how much they were paying performers. So he said, if a performer who appears on my show goes on Parr's show. And performs, he won't be asked back. If he goes on just to talk, then he didn't have any problem with that. So performers were sort of torn because they wanted to be on both shows and didn't know what to do. And then Parr invited Sullivan on his show to have a debate about it. And there was, it was on the cover of Life magazine. It was a big, big deal.
Oh, yeah.
And it never happened because one of them or both of them kind of, I think Parr kind of chickened out because he changed the rules. He wanted to have a studio audience, and Sullivan said, nothing doing that was part of the agreement, no audience. Because Parr knew how to play his audience beautifully and would get all the people, cheering him and booing Sullivan. And Sullivan was smart enough not to go on in that circumstance. So the thing never happened.
Huh.
But that was a big feud.
Now, when Sullivan's show ended in 1971, it doesn't feel like it was that long ago, but I guess it was.
Well, almost 40 years ago, 1971, yeah.
I thought he was on sort of more into the 70s. Was it his decision, or was it a network decision, or was it both?
No, not his decision at all. He was really floored by his decision, because the show had run, it was a habit, it was a national habit, it ran 23 years. It had waned a little, and then it got revived by the Beatles in '64, and then it had a new life in the rock and roll era. But as I go into in the book, it kind of ended up hurting the show in a way, because he lost some of his older core audience and rock acts. A lot of rock acts didn't want to play the Sullivan Show after a while, so he kind of lost touch. And then it was ratings also. It's always ratings. So he was kind of losing some of the steam. The show wasn't. And he was getting older. He was approaching 70, and he was kind of losing a little bit. He had a little bit of early Alzheimer's, his daughter told me. And he was very forgetful, and he sort of lost some traction.
Sure.
And the show just kind of was canceled but it went out. It had a lot of good company. Beverly Hillbillies was canceled, Green Acres, Lassie, The Andy Griffith Show, a lot of major shows where they just, CBS just cleaned house. They had a new president who wanted more hipper, sharper shows on than those.
I'm curious what the lineup was on CBS in 1971-72. What replaced all these? Not that these were all such wonderful shows. I mean,
they brought in some better shows like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which was a little more contemporary. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't no something
yeah,
like
yeah, yeah.
It wasn't like Green Acres and more, some of those shows. And Columbo, I think, was on.
Oh.
And I can't think of any others that are in the book, but they did. But you know, the irony is they replaced the Unsullied Show with a thing called CBS Sunday Night Movie, which is just old movies. So they weren't drawing on the same audience in a way.
Huh. And how much longer did Sullivan live after 71?
Just a couple of years. He died in 73.
Oh, wow.
72 years old. He died in 73. His wife had died the year before, so he lost his show, and then he lost his wife, and he was really kind of a hollowed-out guy by then. And, you know, the show was his whole show, and his wife were the two centers of his life. So he was just, and then he had a terrible ulcer most of his life, which developed into cancer, and then he died.
Now, before I let you go, Gerald Nachman, and it's been, as I figured it would be so much fun to be talking about your journalism career and also your book about comedians and now your book about Ed Sullivan, but you also wrote a book about something that, for obvious reasons, I'm very close to in my heart, growing up on radio.
Oh, yeah.
I was very lucky
to come to be around when radio was in its heyday. It was in my bones, really, and it was really the easiest book for me to write. Although I did a lot of research on that as well and talked to a lot of old-time radio people who are still around, you know, sound effects people and the actors and, you know, some of the writers and stuff that were still around when I wrote it, which was about 10 years ago. So that was a lot of fun to write. That was the closest to my heart of all these.
Sure.
That's called Race on Radio. And I talked about the Lone Ranger and so many shows.
Well, Fibber McGee and Molly and The Dark Shadow and
Shadow, all the westerns, detective shows, quiz shows, every genre, comedy shows, Jack Benny Show and Burns and Allen Show, and you know, it was a lot of fun to write.
What I don't understand, I mean, I guess there are logical explanations for this, but you know, when radio came along, the theater didn't die, you know. When TV came along, the movies didn't die. They took a hit, but movies are still a huge, huge business. Why did radio never really come back?
That's one of the great imponderables and a very, very sad topic, because it could very easily come back overnight. It's a very cheap form. You just need some microphones and scripts and actors stand around. You don't need sets, costumes, or anything like that. It's because people who run radio networks and stations are, you know, want to go for something even cheaper, which is just to have, you know, music, news, and sports, which is the easiest way to go and the cheapest. And nobody has tried to bring it back. Yeah, there are a few shows, you know, on NPR that are like it, most obviously the Garrison Keillor Show,
right.
Prairie Home Companion, and there's a show like Wait, Don't Tell Me, and some of those shows. So there's a handful that are like the old radio shows, but it's nothing like it was with Amos and Andy and Cisco Kid, and you know, it was a rich, rich period.
The old joke about it was radio, and yet people would sit around in the living room and they would look at the radio.
Yeah, I know.
But I understand that.
Yeah.
Because
you were kind of imagining the people inside the radio performing. You know, it was nothing else to look at. But it was because it was all in your head. I mean, it's like in the book I point out that it's the closest thing to reading, where you imagine the characters based on their voices and on the situation. And in that sense, it's the most intimate form of any kind of performance that I can think of. So it, too, was live for many, many years. And it really just held you fascinated. And I put in 3-4 hours a day listening to it after school. You'd have Serial, Superman, and Batman, and, you know, Green Hornet and all that. And then after dinner, you immediately go to my room and start listening to the radio until I had to turn my light off. And then I listened to it under the covers. A lot of us did that, too.
What was your favorite show?
I like the show which old radio fans will remember fondly. Most people haven't heard of, called The Great Gildersleeve, which was it was a sitcom, and it was just about a guy who had a niece and a nephew, and he was trying to raise them, and it was more real than a lot of the other shows. Also, the Jack Benny Show was, you know, probably the best remembered and probably best written of all the shows. And those shows still hold up, and I should say you can still order all these shows. There's a company called Radio Spirits, and you can order tapes of any of these shows. It's still available, and people that don't know about it are amazed at how good they are, that they are available, and B, how many of them hold up. Not all of them, for sure.
Yeah.
Some of them are a little tinny and cheesy sounding now, but a lot of the comedy shows do. The Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy show does. Burns and Allen, Jack Benny, and the Great Gildersleeve that I just mentioned, they all hold up. And there's just, you know, there's thousands. I have probably 1,000 show tapes in my basement right now.
Well, you guys are transferring them to CD or to MP3s, you know, before those. If they're on ferrous oxide tape, they won't be around for
a
while.
Oh, yeah, they're also DVDs. CDs.
Oh, okay.
Also cool. CDs. Oh, sure. You can go to Borders. They used to be able to, and they have box sets of a lot of these shows.
True.
But they're really worth investigating because it's a whole new form, and you'll be transfixed if you don't have any memory of old radio, and if you do, then you'll be transported.
Now, let me ask. You've written the Ed Sullivan book. That is your most recent, called Right Here on Our Stage Tonight. Oh, I can't. I don't even. Not even going to try to imitate Ed Sullivan or Ed Sullivan's
something
America.
Something he said every two or three times during the show.
But you've written it, and since you're a writer, that means you're already thinking about your next project, which will be.
Well, the next thing I think I'm going to write about is nothing to do with. You know, these three books took a lot out of me in terms of research. It's a lot of work and a lot of time, and I want to write a book, a humor book. I want to get back to humor again. I'm writing a humor book about getting older, which I'm living with every day, and everybody says, what's so funny about that? But there are funny things to write about, and so I'm about to send a packet out. My agent and I are going to get together soon and figure out what I've written about it, freelance stuff about the subject, and we hope to find a publisher soon.
I'm kind of curious, I mean, it's none of my business, but I am sort of curious, when you write a book about Ed Sullivan or the comedians, which has a certain audience core of however many thousand people who would want to go out and read it and buy it, and yet you have to work 3 or 4 years on it to make the book right and do the research. Is that how do you make a living?
Well, you get in advance.
Right.
The real answer is investments. It has nothing to do with, you know, it's very hard to make a living in book publishing, or certainly in freelance writing now, because that has kind of dried up. So I never could really do very well freelance writing because, you know, magazines are folding and they're changing and editors change, and it's a nightmare. So I never went that direction. I really went from newspapers right to books, and books are still around and they're still popular, and there's still, you know, bookstores, and even though the little ones are closing, there's still big ones, and there's still online, Amazon and so on. So
but without being John Grisham, you're able still to do a book every, say, 4 years,
something like that,
and feed yourself.
Help from, you know, the money I got from my buyout and, you know, my personal investments and all that. But it would have been hard if I just tried to exist just purely on the advance, unless you really hit it big, like you say, Grisham or Dan Brown or somebody. It's tough, but it's the best thing left, and I still enjoy it. And the only problem with it is you have to wait 4 or 5 years to see the thing happen. And I was very spoiled, you know, from writing on newspapers for most of my career, of having my name in print and having what I wrote in print every 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, you know, 15 hours after you write something,
you get addicted to that, and that was hard. That was hard to give up.
But then again, you have this column that you do every once in a while on The Columnists,
right.
And
so
there
that,
you have it.
But that feeds that part of me in a way, yeah.
So read him at thecolumnists.com. Buy his three books, including Raised on Radio, Seriously Funny, and, of course, the new one right here on our stage tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. Gerald Nachman, great, absolute pleasure to talk to you about all these things.
Well, thank you for having me on, David. It's been great fun talking. talking to you, and you're very well informed, and you've obviously read the books, and